and the extent of Arctic ice is diminishing by more than 500,000 square miles every year. And so the physical world in which polar bears live and on which they depend completely is rapidly shrinking. There are some climatic models that predict if the climate keeps warming at the present pace, the Arctic Ocean will be no longer covered with ice in the summer. And that means for polar bears that their world is gone. Polar bears are also encountering more industrial development in many parts of the Arctic. Except where they're drawn by food, like these whale remains along the coast at certain times of the year, polar bears tend to leave areas where there are lots of human activity. They don't particularly like our company, our noise, our fracas, our machines. And as I watch these animals, I think of how vulnerable polar bears are whenever they den on land. There's a fair likelihood that these two cubs were born in a den somewhere along the shoreline here or on the ice just offshore. In Alaska, actually the highest density of polar bear dens on land is right here along the coast of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The United States, incidentally, is the only Arctic nation that doesn't have a sanctuary set aside specifically for polar bears, but the Arctic Refuge has this particular role. It's also the only American national wildland where polar bears regularly den and give birth to their cubs. This is important because female polar bears only do that in places where they're not going to be disturbed. A disturbed polar bear will almost certainly leave her den, and if she does that, any cubs that she has will inevitably die. This has been another subject in the long debate over whether the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge should be opened for oil exploration and drilling and construction of an industrial petrochemical complex, or whether the Arctic Refuge should remain as it is today. Well, this gathering of polar bears here reminds me of Churchill over in Manitoba, Canada, on the coast of Hudson Bay. Every year, polar bears in that area attract crowds of tourists, wildlife enthusiasts, filmmakers, photographers from all over the world. And so the polar bears themselves in that area have actually become an industry for the community of Churchill. Perhaps a similar potential might exist for these bears here on the Beaufort Sea coast and for the people of Alaska's coastal Arctic villages. It's a fascinating chapter in the long and intertwined history of people and polar bears here on the far frozen edge of the North American continent. Listen to these polar bears right now. I see one, two, three, four more heading this direction. What a place to be right now, keeping company with polar bears, something that I absolutely never imagined I'd have the chance to do. And I'm so glad that you've been here with me. For Encounters, I'm Richard Nelson. Thanks so much for your good company. I'll see you next time.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Encounters, Radio Experiences in the North, which is funded by the National Science Foundation and produced by Lisa Bush, with special consulting by Ken Fate. For more information about Encounters, check out our website at encountersnorth.org. Sprouts is distributed and coordinated by Pacifica Radio Network. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Ludenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. This week's producer was Richard Nelson at KCAW in Sitka, Alaska. I'm Lisa Bush. Thanks for listening. See you next week on Sprouts.
My name is...
Hello.
And next up on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.1 FM and freakradio.org, it's Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, the April 17, 2008 show. Stay tuned.
You say you love me for now, for certain you say whatever you think I want to hear. You say that it's now or never, if not forever, at least we're here. You say it's not it.
That was from Uncle Banzai, Men and Women, and the name of that was Bedroom Eyes. Well, welcome to Free Radio's Bathroom Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. Next 2 hours or, well, an hour and 50 minutes, I'll be here in the studio answering calls at 427-3772 if you'd like to call in. May get a guest call from Homeless Issues Task Force Chair, actually the former Homeless Issues Task Force. It's a the only body convened by the city in its history that involved homeless issues that I'm aware of that kind. And it lasted for a year, came out with all kinds of recommendations with the Santa Cruz City Council, then promptly ignored. Linda was chair of that, and I'm going to give her a call Also expect in the studio Becky Johnson, who's going to be talking about the Jason Pascal case. Jason is an African-American tarot card reader who has been persistently harassed by police, arrested, and recently, finally after 8 months, got another charge dismissed. We actually spoke to him on the air at the last show on Sunday. That's Sundays from 9:30 to 1, for those of you who want to tune in to our morning show. And she's going to be talking about an article she's writing, as well as the latest developments in that case. Who knows, maybe a civil lawsuit. Who knows what's cooking with Jason Pascal and the how kindly African-American activists, some of them, can be treated in Santa Cruz, particularly in downtown Pacific Avenue, or on downtown Pacific Avenue. So, spent a lot of time on Sunday talking about, and on Thursday, actually, last week, talking about the Obama delegate race and the issue of Mayor Ryan Coonerty's run for one of the two delegate slots, actually. One was for a man, one was for a woman, so there's only one that was really up for Obama delegates. I think there were three up for Hillary delegates, Clinton delegates. And after the show, I went out there with a number of other folks to try to encourage the delegates to be aware of Coonerty's record and to encourage them not to vote for him, and because of his stance on specifically four issues, but actually many more. But the four we mentioned in the four bans that Coonerty has backed or initiated: the sleeping ban, law against sleeping at night if you're poor and homeless in a town with 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people outside tonight. Now, with the Winter Armory closed 2 nights ago, we have a total of 60 spaces at most for all those people. The rest face tickets, $97 tickets, if the police choose to give them. And leaving this in the hands of the police, you get about 80 tickets a month. On what basis do they choose that some get them and some don't? Oh, well, the claim from Councilmember Rotkin is, well, that some have complaints about them, or some are protest sleepers. We'll talk about that more as well. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, I was trying to get Jeff Ditter.
You're trying?
I'm at the dial wrong, excuse me.
Sure. My goodness, a wrong number. Oh, well. Well, try again if you're, try for the first time if you feel like you want to talk on any of these issues. 427-3772. Again, talking about the Mayor Coonerty's defeat at the Obama delegate selection process last Sunday, which happened out at Cabrillo College. The four bans that Coonerty supports, as I mentioned, is the sleeping ban, I call it the assembly ban, because he bans all public assemblies in 10 square blocks downtown, parking lots and garages, even though you pay for them with your public money. They've been traditionally open to the public. Now, that's not good enough. He and the council have decided it's too much of a threat for you to be able to chat there or sit in your car and read a book for 16 minutes. And we've talked about this at great length on the air. But police department would prefer, you see, it's easier for them, the police, if they can just see someone there and then consider them a criminal. And that way they can either move them along or interrogate them, search them, cite them. And it's a nice, useful tool for the police, for those who like to exchange basic liberties. In order to provide the police with useful tools, Coonerty's law is not a bad idea. You can obviously hear how I think and feel about that. The third ban that Coonerty supports is the... let me check. Look at my flyer here. I want to make sure that I don't completely forget what I'm talking about. Sleeping ban, the ban on public comment. Ah, yes, the city council. That's something that will be coming up again this Tuesday. The city council consent agenda is that section of the city council agenda. The city council meets twice a month. It's our legislative body at the city level. It makes all the laws, passes the proclamations, passes the appropriations, decides whether your claim against the city, if you're suing them for something or you're asking them to repair a damage they made because of an injury they caused, they decide whether to accept it or not. Actually, they just rubber stamp what the staff tells them to do often, But in theory, they are the kind of the board of last resort on these issues. Although I suppose you can go to court as well, and that's always another option. But at the legislative political level, they're the people you go to, these seven council members that are elected every 2 years in staggered four-year terms. There's an election coming up this year as well in November. Is it for three or four? I'm not sure. I got to consult what happened last time. I think it's might be four. Not sure. Anyway, most of the city council business is done in the afternoon these days because I suppose the rationale is it's cheaper that way. The staff is there anyway, and so they're the ones who can answer questions rather than have them come at night when it's a little more expensive or might last a little longer or might provide the public some opportunity to put in some real public input in a physical and concrete way. And that's often more important than emails or phone calls or letters. It's actually being there and speaking up, or being there and demanding to speak up when the chair tries to shut everybody down, which can result in the chairs opening up the floor because the people actually want to speak. That actually happened with the Obama delegations, not at City Council, but you may recall from reading in the Sentinel last week, the bigwigs at the center of the Democratic Party were forced to reverse their decision to cut back on who could run for Obama delegates, who would be the appropriate. Well, they tried to cut back the number of people who could run because they said too many people are running. And there was so much protest from the grassroots that they had to allow everybody who was running to run. It didn't actually turn out to be that many people. I think it was a list of about 20, 24 people, something like that. Yeah, you know, it took two or three hours in the afternoon out at Cabrillo College, but it didn't take that long. Similarly, city council meetings usually used to be, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 hours long in the evening, or 2 or 3 hours long on some evenings. And then because there was needed more time, as old council watcher Ed Davidson would remind us, he's a guy who comes to council meetings and has been protesting how city council has been cutting back on public comment and changing its rules to make it much more difficult for people to raise issues, even those that are on the agenda. They created afternoon sessions, according to Ed, as overflow for the evening. Well, it became convenient for city council members to cram everything onto the afternoon sessions as much as they can. So you will never have a city council meeting with an evening session and no afternoon session, but you will occasionally, more and more frequently, have afternoon sessions with no evening sessions, which means that people who can't show up at 3 o'clock and talk about the majority of the agenda items and the majority of the money committed by the city council don't get to talk about it at all, although they might be more available in the evening since most people work during the day and presumably are off during the evening. Ironically, with homeless people, it's kind of the other way around in the sense that if you are lucky enough to get into the shelter, although I'm not suggesting it's a great boon, the shelter system that is there, but you have to be in by 4 o'clock. So if you have to, it's actually hard for you to even get to the 3 o'clock session, but I guess in theory you can. An evening session is out unless you wish to sleep illegally outside, which is a $97 ticket if you're found and a technical crime. And that, of course, is something that we're all fighting, those of us who are involved with these kinds of issues, with a lawsuit against our municipal code that makes it illegal for homeless people to, and this is hard to believe, but the words are there, sleep after 11 o'clock at night. From 11 to 8:30 in the morning, in on or under any structure not intended for human habitation, in a vehicle, on any public property, and even on much private property. It's a very draconian ban, which gave the police lots of tools to go after people they didn't like the look and the smell of, even though these people are engaged in innocent behavior, in fact, necessary behavior. And I talked about how Los Angeles, San Diego, Fresno, Richmond threw out all these laws. And this is an issue at the Obama delegation selection process because Mayor Coonerty, when confronted on these issues, supports the sleeping ban. His father seems to think he doesn't. I met Neil Coonerty, the supervisor, in line and chatted with him. Well, he kind of roared at me and I chatted back. He's a hard man to out-roar, Neil Coonerty. He's insisted that his son didn't support the sleeping band because the sleeping band was created in 1978 before he was born. And I said, yeah, that's true. But it's in force every day he's in office, and he's responsible for either, you know, supporting its continuance or recommending its removal. And when confronted, he tries to avoid those confrontations as much as possible. But there was a long, hour-long debate between Don Zimmerman of the ACLU, Kate Wells, the attorney who's doing the sleeping ban lawsuit, and Mayor Coonerty back in, he was a vice mayor at that time, I believe. Actually, may have just become mayor. On community TV, and you can find it online. Just go to Santa Cruz Indie Bay, IndyBay, and go to that website after you Google for it, and you'll find, again, look for Coonerty sleeping ban, and you'll find that whole discussion. You can see him and his two opponents arguing about it. Coonerty supports the current law, and as strange as his father was saying he didn't, I think he just wanted to denounce me as a liar because he kept saying I was a liar. And I said, well, I don't think so. But, if it gives your heart, does your heart good to say that, then please, say I'm a liar. And actually, I was standing next to Ryan Coonerty as he shook everybody's hand in line and in a politician fashion. And I would give everyone a flyer talking about Coonerty's position on the different bans, the sleeping ban, the assembly ban on the 15-minute parking lot rule, which actually makes it illegal to walk into a parking lot at all, unless you have a car or vehicle there. I'm looking for it online now. It's really a speaking ban of a kind. It's a ban on any kind of communication on the overwhelming majority of topics at the city council afternoon agenda. He's changed the rules so that you can't pull an item from the agenda for a specific discussion as you could in the past and be given a small but significant amount of time, 1, 2, 3 minutes to talk on it. Instead, you get a total of 2 minutes for all items on the afternoon agenda. And that'll be the case on Tuesday when the city council convenes. And who knows, maybe we'll have some people there to discuss this policy that could be happening. And the fourth one is I called it the activist ban. There is the sleeping ban, the public assembly ban, the speaking ban, and the activist ban. And that actually is a way of describing how he treated activists in front of his store, his bookshop Santa Cruz, when we were trying to get some dialogue going on the sleeping ban. And encouraging people who think somehow that Coonerty is some progressive figure and that the elder Coonerty is a progressive figure and that this is the kind of political leadership which we want in this town because it's so progressive, when in fact it's not, at least around the issues of homelessness, community control of police, the drug war. Coonerty did not stand up for making marijuana the lowest enforcement priority. He hasn't come out for ending the drug war in Santa Cruz locally. He's your standard duck and cover politician, and it's kind of sad in that way. Although I'm sure there are other issues which Coonerty is, some people like him on. I mean, he is, after all, a downtown merchant, and I presume is closer to the merchant sensibility than certain other council members, sort of another Cynthia Matthews, another Lynn Robinson. Lynn Robinson is a council member who kind of prided herself on being who works on pruning parks and rec stuff on Pacific Avenue and elsewhere. But when she hit the city council, she wouldn't talk to people at all. She was very friendly. At least she wouldn't talk to me and other activists. Very friendly initially getting elected, and then, of course, she could afford to put on airs, close the door, talk to the special groups. And that's been another concern about Coonerty. Anyway, there were the four bans, the speaking ban, the sleeping ban, the activist ban, the public assembly ban, and they apparently did the trick. Coonerty lost the vote at the Obama delegation, lost by at least 40 votes. And then there's been a very long discussion on Indie Media, Santa Cruz Indie Media, about this. 104 comments so far. What I did was I posted the results. I kind of talked about what happened. Well, first I talked about the Coonerty record and so forth. And But then I posted the email exchange. I guess this actually was already up on Sunday when I talked about it as well, between the mayor and Matea Bramana, who was a man running for a delegate status, African-American guy, who was in the studio last week and who actually kind of led the charge against Coonerty. I never heard of him before. He's not a big homelessness civil rights advocate, but he is someone who has been homeless, and he is someone who feels very strongly that Obama delegates should have certain qualifications, which I think I agree with him. Coonerty simply does not have. And frankly, I mean, I don't deny that I don't believe in rewarding politicians who get to be mayor and then criminalize homeless people or continue the criminalization policies of the past. I think it is outrageous. And I think, you know, it's actually business as usual in a lot of cities. And that's a point that's been made by people on this thread on indiebate.org talking about this whole delegate selection process. And the issue here is, I mean, I don't support Obama either, you know, for a number of reasons. I think he's, you know, essentially a mainstream politician who says a lot of jovial things. Reminds me of Hubert H. Humphrey, the politics of hope is what Humphrey called his politics in 1968. He was LBJ's vice president. Obama doesn't have that albatross around his neck, but he does have the albatross of voting repeatedly for military appropriations in the general military budget and of having a seat in the Senate but refusing to filibuster, that kind of stuff, or even trying to filibuster. Wayne Morse had the courage to do it back in the 50s and 60s. I don't see why Obama can't do it now, you know, in the turn of the century. So I'm not a big Obama guy. And in fact, on the show today, I'm probably going to be talking about Matt Gonzalez, the vice presidential candidate running with Ralph Nader, and his critique of Obama. And I think it's important not because you necessarily would want to support Nader, or I'm not running for any particular candidate, but you want the candidates to reflect a get-the-hell-out-of-Iraq policy now, yesterday, in fact, and an impeachment policy. And you want them to reflect a policy that holds this government accountable and eliminates all the legislation that has given the executive so much power in recent years to set up torture camps and private prisons and do extreme rendition. And the Democratic candidates aren't saying much about this. You don't hear Obama talking about this. You don't hear Hillary talk. And more important, whether they talk about it or not, Nader talks about it, you know. But the people who are in the Senate who could do something about it, even if not much, but they could introduce resolutions, I don't see a lot happening. Now, I got to be honest, I haven't checked what resolutions Obama and Clinton have introduced recently. So, but still, the most obvious one is the war that's eating us all up and murdering and displacing millions of people in Iraq. And that is still going on, and it shows no signs of actually stopping even after either of these people are elected, whether it's McCain, Obama, or Clinton, regardless of what they say, unless we force them to do that. And that is really what we have to do. That's our job. And that's why I think it's really important to raise these issues. Similarly with Coonerty. Coonerty, you know, is a nice enough guy. I don't think he has a hard-on to kill or hurt homeless people. But he is concerned with kind of keeping an even keel, not rocking the boat, and he wants to be elected to higher office, doesn't want to offend other merchants in the community. But the peculiar thing about Coonerty is he's a constitutional lawyer, or at least he claims to be, and a teacher of constitutional law at two places, the University up on the Hill, UCSC and Cabrillo. And, you know, I mean, I want to stand outside with a horn honking as he comes out of class, saying, who the hell do you think you're trying to fool with this kind of stuff? But again, it has to be said, almost every politician who gets to be mayor in the last decade has been as bad as Coonerty or worse. Well, Coonerty's gotten pretty bad. This parking assembly ban, public assembly ban in parking lots is something, Cynthia Matthews supported it. It's true. It came from Matthews, I think Robinson and Coonerty. Anyway, I've been talking so long that my attempt to talk to involve Linda LeMaster, who I promised I would kind of try to hook into this is probably not going to work. I believe she's got some sort of conference call. She's a Green Party person who has Green Party doings. I'm always mocking her about this since I don't think much of the statewide Green Party either, frankly. I guess I'm savage on a lot of these groups. In the studio with me, however, I would like to introduce the band, Becky Johnson, back in the studio at last. Becky, are you intending to ravage the studio, list names and steal records? What are your plans here?
Yes, exactly. I'm here gathering surveillance.
Right. Send it to some right-wing websites, are we?
Of course.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll give you the names, phone numbers, and addresses, as well as the bank numbers of everybody in the collective, and you can do that. I'm kind of sarcastic about this because we have our own problems in Free Radio Santa Cruz, and Becky, who hosted Free Radio in her house for several years.
Twice.
In two different residences, and risked her tenancy, and came to meetings regularly, and who I think at that time, I always regarded her as a member of the collective, got aced and sliced and leveraged out. And we've talked about this ad nauseum in the past. When she tried to come to a Free Radio Santa Cruz meeting to defend herself, Uncle Dennis, who follows me on the evening show, and Phil Free, both of whom I have a lot of respect for in other contexts, blocked her way and wouldn't let her in the studio. Full disclosure, Becky and I were a couple for, six years, something like that. And we've been friends and coworkers for a decade or more. So,
More importantly, I produced your radio show at Free Radio Santa Cruz for 11 years. Mm-hmm. And I do distinctly remember when I was voted in as a member. But since Free Radio Santa Cruz meetings keep no minutes, there's no record to look to. It's just
Or they didn't. They do now, but they didn't then. So.
It was such a...
Yeah, and also there was very strong feelings had to do with. I mean, you and I have disagreements. I side with the Free Radio Collective's views on, opposing, not agreeing with you on the issues of Israeli government policy. But that should be neither here nor there. Anyway, it's an old issue, and it's not that I want to raise it at great length. But I mention it because for me, it's something that the Free Radio Collective needs to correct, and I keep hoping that at some point in the future it will do that. I'm not the best diplomat to do it. It needs a greater character than I to get it together. But anyway, Becky, you're not here on that mission. You're here on another mission. You were in court on Monday in the case of Jason Pascal.
Yeah, that's correct.
This is a guy, of course, who was on the air. Well, he's been on the air repeatedly. If you go to the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org, and then you go to the old Bathrop's Piers Broadsides shows, that's the name of the show, Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, you can... search for the name Jason, J-A-S-O-N, and you'll find some old shows which discuss the kind of grim consequences he's been subject to by police officers on Pacific Avenue in downtown Santa Cruz. Where do you want to begin this, Becky? Why don't you kind of lay out the landscape for us, if you'd like, unless you want me to.
Well, I think that perhaps your listeners could hear another voice for... here, let me...
Remember, I control the mic here, Becky, so watch your step.
I'm well aware of that. Is my mic on, by the way?
Well, we'll find out after the show is over.
Is it a proper volume? I mean...
We could put it up higher. I could drop my mic lower if you'd like.
let me start at the end, which was last Monday. When I attended court and Commissioner Stephen Siegel's court in Department 1 at Santa Cruz County Courthouse with Jason Pascal. And he was a criminal defendant based on a citizen complaint that was filed on July 15th, 2007 on Pacific Avenue in front of O'Neill's surf shop. The person who filed the complaint, April, and this was last July. Jason was still trying to get to the arraignment stage of his case because he wanted to plead not guilty and get a jury trial. He had been arrested on a misdemeanor offensive words charge, use of offensive words in a public place, and he felt that he had freedom of speech and that he had done nothing wrong, and he wanted to plead not guilty and get a jury trial. Well, he went to Judge Tom Kelly's court and attempted that, and Kelly went over in a sidebar with his public defender, who was Kristen Carter at that point.
Let me interrupt you. This happened. The whole incident happened way back in July, right?
Yes, July 15th, 2007.
And he didn't get to Kelly's court until, what, January or February, right?
Right.
And what was the reason for so long a delay? I know he left town, did he not? He went down to Venice Beach, where he is now working as a kind of a vendor and a, you know, a spiritualist, a street hustler, if you will, where the word hustler is not meant as a negative connotation, but as a person who's a hawker. You know, he talks about, you know, spiritualism and regard, you know, he does readings of palms and readings of cards, and people have seen him on Pacific Avenue. If you've been around for 3 or 4 years, you've seen him out there, often near O'Neill's, a block or in that general area, a little bit up the street from O'Neill's. But it took a whole 7 or 8 months to get in. Why the delay in this whole case coming up, even before it reached Kelly's court?
Well, there was a tremendous delay in getting all the records that were necessary for the case. The police and the DA, for whatever reason, decided to split what happened in a 4-minute period at the same location with the same people up into two separate cases that had nothing to do with each other, or so they said. And Jason was very insistent he get the records of this other case where he was claiming that he was the victim of an assault, where a man had spit upon him, and, well, actually, he had come over on a bicycle, and he said, "O'Neill's has been here a lot longer than you have. Get the fuck out of town, nigger," and spit in his face, which, under penal code, is a battery.
Assault.
It's actually a battery offense.
Battery.
If the spittle
touching.
Actually touches your person.
It also can be an assault if you feel threatened in some way, if there is some indication of a threat.
Yes. So Jason had briefly pursued the man on the bicycle. Of course, he was on a bicycle, and he was able to escape fairly quickly. It was at that point that the customer from O'Neill's, a man named Bill Chapman, had placed a 911 phone call to the police. And he claimed that Jason was physically threatening people at that location. And so the police came. Now, Jason, who, after his brief pursuit of the bicyclist, placed his own 911 call 4 minutes after Chapman did. But when the police arrived, they came and arrested Jason.
Do you think they had? Do we know? Have any indication from the records that they had knowledge of both calls?
Yes, both calls are recorded, and I believe I have copies of the 911 calls here. Although,
should we play those calls?
Well, I don't know. My machine wouldn't play them.
We can try and see if the studio machine is a better machine.
It might
than
be
yours.
The very first time anyone's ever heard these calls, but. Sadly, I'm not sure what their little codes are.
Well, let's try this one and
see.
This
one says 911 calls. What does that say?
It's got a strange number on it.
Okay, that one is probably... Play that one first. I'm pretty sure that one is O'Neill's manager, Mark McKay's, interview with Officer Vasquez on the day of the incident.
Okay, here we go. If this
works. Is about 10 in the morning.
Let's see if this works. And it doesn't look like it does. It looks like something is happening on the machine, but we can't hear nothing. Let me try it on the other machine, but I think if you had problems with this before, it may be this is simply not going to work for us. So let's see.
I couldn't understand why one would play and the other...
Effective copies. All right, let's see what we got here.
why the other two wouldn't.
And interestingly enough, this one doesn't even play. Oh, wait, it is playing. But it's... Well, we can't, we're not able to monitor it. Wait a minute. It's something is playing. Let's see. Because I see... No, that's my voice. I'm seeing my own voice go up and down on the board here.
But only when you're talking, Robert.
Apparently so. Well, it's interesting. It looks like the police department or the DA's office has given Jason another bum steer, so to
All
speak.
All right. You want to try the next one? This one does say 911 calls
on
it.
Here's 911 calls. Let's see if we can actually find a 911 call. This is your on-the-air testing as we go in the studio. And looks like 9 minutes. No, it looks like 8 seconds, but there's nothing that we can see. Nope.
Don't you love technology?
Well, so that's two discs down and one to go. It's pretty exciting stuff
yeah.
here.
I'm sure your audience is just fascinated by our investigative journalism
anyway,
here.
What would these things have shown if we were able to play them? I mean, was Jason able to hear them?
Well, Jason placed one of them.
He played one of them? Maybe this
Jason
was the one he played.
Jason placed one of the 911 calls. Mark McKay placed the first one. He's the manager of the O'Neills. And when he placed his call, the police came out and they informed Jason that he had 1 hour to move along.
That's under the famous Porter Riley move along law, also the Rutkin Matthew move along law, that which is actually kind of unique. I say kind of because I believe there's one other city where it's done, which says that you have to move along an hour after you're informed if you set up a display device. Not if you're blocking the sidewalk, but you have to move along just because that's sort of the decision of our elders, that you're only allowed a certain amount of time for free speech. The rest of the time, you just better move along. We actually had a voluntary set of street performers guidelines that voluntarily had people cooperating with each other, but not as any kind of legal requirement, since the First Amendment says people can stand where they are and speak.
All right. Well, in this case, had the police, when they came up and they saw the way that Jason was addressing the public and many people, were offended by the way he was addressing the public on that day, because he was not doing his crystal reading and tarot card readings and things like that that day. That day he was there specifically to protest the treatment that he had experienced in Santa Cruz leading up to that point. And that was after a year-long stay-away order that he had endured, which he had not violated a single time.
The famous backdoor order, as I remember.
Yeah, it had a strange stipulation. Jason Pascal, who is an African-American gentleman, the stipulation, he asked if he would be able to frequent the businesses on Pacific Avenue. And the judge says, oh, yeah, you can still go to the businesses on Pacific Avenue, but you'll just have to use the back door. And, of course, that has racial in tones to it.
It also means you can't go into half the businesses because half the businesses don't have a back door.
Under Jim Crow, African Americans that was often the only way they were allowed to enter a business. We consider ourselves more civilized than that, but apparently not.
And again, the reason he got this initial stay-away order was because he, raped
that
someone downtown?
Stay-away order...
Broke windows?
Resulted when he had been also on another occasion a victim of an assault, and he had called the police and asked for protection. I guess you could call it an aggressive panhandling case where one of the people who had come around his table panhandled him, and Jason gave him $1. And since the guy was someone who he would characterize as a neo-Nazi skinhead, his description, because he said the guy was had a shaved head, and he had little SS tattoos on his arm. that, and was always talking about white power. And so Jason said, I'm surprised that you panhandled, because I thought you guys were always talking about white power. I thought you'd be ashamed to do that. Well, the guy took instant offense and started screaming at Jason and picked up rocks and started throwing rocks at Jason near the bus stop.
This is all according to Jason's account, or were there other witnesses who confirmed this?
That I'm not sure. That you were talking about what was the instance that got the stay away order. So he called police, and they were able to identify the person. They even arrested the person. And then Jason waited for the court process to proceed, and he wanted that person who had assaulted him prosecuted. And then when he called up to find out what was going on with the case, he found out that the man had been released, all charges had dropped, and they said, well, since you were homeless, we couldn't get in contact with you, so we dropped all charges. And Jason was furious about that.
This was back in, what, 2005 or something? Or? And I'm kind of going into the history because people should understand this isn't the first time this has happened, but if you haven't got all your records lined up right now.
That was October 2005.
So Jason was unable to get this previous assault, the police to act on, or the DA.
I have to finish that sentence. The reason he was upset was that he had a working cell phone the entire time, and they had never placed a call to him. It wasn't like they couldn't get in touch with him. Well, they just didn't try. And so he was very upset that here he had been, had this history where he had previously been arrested for misdemeanor, possession of a milk crate, two narcotics charges for possession of paraphernalia, he's a diabetic and he had insulin needles with him, and he was arrested for those insulin needles.
Sergeant Butchie Baker was involved in a lot of all this, right?
Willie Brandt gave him issued him a ticket for tarot card reading without a license.
Oh, well, that's a serious crime, yeah.
Despite the fact that the city of Santa Cruz does not issue any licenses for tarot card reading.
And despite the fact you'll find a tarot card reader near the Gap almost, and it used to anyway, the last month or two, any night of the week.
I don't think that law is really enforced because it has certain free speech constitutional problems, except for when they want to.
African-American tarot card readers they don't like. Certainly could be one lesson to be drawn from this. I'm looking at an even earlier story, jailing of the Reverend, because I guess he called himself the Reverend, Jason Pascal did.
Yeah. He considers himself an artist and street performer. He does have some kind of colorful stage names that he uses, which I could probably dig out of here somewhere.
Reverend Dr. Jason, I guess you yourself wrote a story back in 2003. I'm looking online for those who are interested. You can Google for jailing of the Reverend raises First Amendment issues back in the Santa Cruz Indie Media days when it was called Santa Cruz Indie Media, not Santa Cruz Indie Bay. You write extensively about how he was, you kind of critique the Santa Cruz Sentinel's article talking about how Jason Pascal is mentally ill and he has his problems, and that really this is an example of somebody who just can't control himself, and it's a real difficulty. And you kind of go through the details of, we talked about this year, last year, 2007, we talked about 2005. Here's 2003, the same kind of thing is happening to him.
Even if that is the case, you have to make the case that
mental
he
illness,
was...
I mean.
Even if it is the case that he is suffering from a mental illness, and I know that his mother has identified him as suffering from bipolar condition, even if that's the case, you still have to have actually committed a crime for the police to cite or arrest you. Just simply saying uncomfortable statements or statements with swear words in them is not enough to arrest a person, certainly not enough to banish them from the entire Pacific Avenue for a whole year and force an African-American gentleman to use the back door of every business.
It was even worse than that. I believe he was deported to New Hampshire and held in jail for a couple months on an old marijuana charge, which the New Hampshire authorities originally refused to prosecute him on, to send people to pick him up, and Sergeant Baker kept pressing on
this. You want me to go into that a little bit? I could read a little bit from this article about that.
Okay.
This is called, in a section called Defacing New Hampshire. Sergeant Lauren Butchie Baker made it his mission to run Jason Pascal out of town. Rather than apologizing to him for seizing his needles and insulin, Baker continued to press for a way to remove Pascal from downtown. He was frustrated that New Hampshire showed no interest in extradition and that Pascal was now a legitimate medical marijuana patient in California. New Hampshire was reluctant to send officers across the entire continent to pick up a parole violator who had already served 8 months in prison, 4 months in a halfway house, and had 8 months left to serve. All this for a single incident when he was a teenager in which he sold half an ounce of pot to an undercover agent. But still, authorities there didn't want to bother performing extradition. Pascal was again released from prison, from county jail. But Baker did not give up. He continued to call multiple agencies in New Hampshire and demanded they come and pick up Pascal. On April 1st, 2003, Baker again jailed Pascal for the old warrant and put New Hampshire on his speed dialer. On May 3rd, Baker's campaign paid off. New Hampshire agreed to send federal marshals to transport Pascal back to serve the rest of his sentence for that half ounce of grass sold back in 1998. Ironically, as Jason Pascal sat in jail awaiting extradition to New Hampshire so that justice could be served, Mayor Emily Riley and Supervisor Marty Wormhout held a press conference in front of the Santa Cruz County Courthouse to support a lawsuit by the Women and Men's Alliance for Medical Marijuana, or WAM, against the federal DEA seeking an end to raids on WAM gardens. Baker's persistence, New Hampshire deputies arrived and transported Pascal back to New Hampshire prison. On May 3rd, the day he arrived back in New Hampshire, the iconic granite Old Man of the Mountain stone face, memorialized on the New Hampshire State Quarter, the state emblem, and on the United States 1955 3-cent postage stamp, slid off the mountain forever.
What does that mean?
It was a very famous outcropping of granite that was was called the Old Man of the Mountain, mm-hmm. and it was really kind of like the most iconic symbol for the whole state of New Hampshire, and just weather and rain and everything. Ironically, the same day Jason was extradited back to New Hampshire, the face fell off of the state.
Well, I guess, you know, and you're going to be putting this article up. I know you're going to make this article may show up in numerous publications soon, including Santa Cruz Indie Media and other places. The Huff website, I guess.
Yeah, we hope to see it on the Huff website within a day or two.
Let me ask you this, and of course, if anybody would like to call in, by the way, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. And we're talking with Becky Johnson about the Jason Pascal case. We kind of the phone number is 427-3772, 427-3772. We kind of dropped back into Pascal's history to show that on at least two prior occasions, there were three series of harassment cycles of Jason Pascal and a kind of a combined determination to remove him from the scene. And the most recent one, of course, began in July of 2007 with this arrest in front of O'Neill's. I guess you and I and others were doing a boycott bigotry protest in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, and we ran into Jason, and he was in front of O'Neill's protesting the store, and then suddenly he was in handcuffs and taken away. I don't think I was there when that happened. I heard about it, and I actually interviewed some of the O'Neill staff afterward. And then for the last 9 months, he's faced the charge of fighting words or disturbing the peace, right?
Yeah, offensive words in a public place, a misdemeanor.
What he called somebody, he said somebody, a guy, a cunt? Who
well,
came up to
according
him,
to the police report, Bill Chapman states in the police report.
Bill Chapman, again, is?
He was the customer who filed the complaint.
Okay, the one who complained about the bad words.
He was the one that placed the second 911 call, and the one that was placed 4 minutes before Jason placed his call.
So the first 911 call.
Actually, the first 911 call was about 10 o'clock in the morning when Mark McKay of O'Neill's called and made a 911 call. And that was when the police came out and told Jason he had an hour to move along.
And he then moved from a place kind of across the street from the Cinema 9, but relatively further away from the cinema, the O'Neill's front door, to a position on Cooper Street.
More on the Cooper Street closer. Side of.
But originally he was not on the Cooper Street side. Originally
no.
he was on the Pacific Avenue. He moved 100 feet. I guess he felt that O'Neill's had intentionally tried to eliminate to get him to move along.
Exactly.
Because
he was upset that O'Neill's had invoked the move along law against him.
Right, because the move along law is not usually enforced on Pacific Avenue, just as the panhandling law is selectively enforced by police who decide who they want to go after.
It is sporadically and enforced, and many people it's not enforced against.
Right, and in a way you can say, well, see how sweet and nice the police are, you know? I mean, look at how, see, they just want to only go after people who are being abusive or aggressive. And the problem with that is that sometimes, you know, where the rubber meets the road, like with Jason, you have a situation where he was, I guess, very outspoken about these past instances of discrimination he'd suffered, the back door, coming to the back door of Pacific mm-hmm. Avenue. You know, we're conducting the drug war against African-Americans and actually...
The police failure to protect him when he was the victim of an actual assault.
And he was talking about how his opinion that downtown Santa Cruz was a racist merchant community and that he encouraged people to boycott these stores. He did so in a fashion that I think... that alienated not just merchants, but also, I would say, some street people, some normal panhandlers, folks who prefer a more mellow tone in the Santa Cruz streets. He's a kind of got a ghetto tone to his speech. He's very outspoken. He can be very harsh. I wouldn't say he's threatening, but I would say he, you know, expresses his emotions directly in a way that I think discomforts middle-class people.
Here, let me quote again from my article, and this is Jason Pascal. He said, I come from a long line of fighters. I'm a warrior. I'm a spiritualist. I like to be confrontational sometimes, if the situation warrants it being confrontational. I'm a big man. I weigh almost 250 pounds, but I can't fight back physically. I have to use my words. Most of all, I cherish my freedom. I am well aware that this country started out as a slave nation. As far as I'm concerned, they should give the entire state of California to African Americans to atone for that.
Well, you'd have to talk to the Native Americans and I guess the Mexican Americans who were here as well.
He's also stated that he feels
Americans.
Part of his purpose is to be a mirror for society.
And I think the point is that... Anyway, to get an idea of what's going on, I mean, there was some concern. Police showed up and spoke about, you know, and you know, were differential in how they treated him. They didn't take his complaint seriously, but they prosecuted him for what he was doing. Now, some people would say, well, what if you got some foul-mouthed character who's ragging on? You can call it First Amendment. You can call it whatever you want. But if it goes on for a long period of time, and for Jason, I imagine, I'm told it went on for some time. I mean, I've talked to activists, people who passed by, who were offended by what he said and what he did. So
Here, let me read directly from a police report here.
Before you do, let's see if you can answer this question for me.
And it is from a witness that day.
Right, right. And I want to hear that. But I've heard from other witnesses who I interviewed directly who said to me that they thought he was way out of bounds, way overboard. They didn't like it. I don't think they necessarily wanted him arrested, but they felt they were upset by what he said. I guess you might say, so one of the purposes of free speech is to upset you, but I don't know, you know, or you want to protect people. You don't need to protect free speech protections for people whose what they say is not upsetting, because there's going to be no problem with them. No one's going to come after them. But you've talked to Jason. You've had him on your TV show, Becky. I know you did a community TV show, Club Cruise, for a long time. I guess you're now on sabbatical on that one. This is a guy who can be very offensive. He tends to repeat himself a lot.
Yeah, and I'm sure you don't, right?
I only emphasize important points. You know that, Becky.
I see.
And fuck you as well, I might add. So if anybody has any thoughts on this, I know that some people may be listening who have a different point of view as to Jason's innocence and so forth. You can give a call, 427-3772. The issue to me is selective enforcement against someone. And when the cops can show up, it seems to me that cools off the situation. They don't have to throw him into a 7 or 8 or 9 month merry-go-round of prosecution, particularly when somebody came up and spat in his face. That crime is ignored. I think there are more serious crimes than spitting in someone's face, or than calling a person a nigger, or a cunt, or a bum, or a bearded, aging, whatever M would call me that might, you know, be abusive to me.
Well, in the police report, Chapman and his wife was called a cunt, but Chapman's wife wasn't on the scene. She wasn't there.
According to
Bill Chapman, who I interviewed by telephone yesterday.
Did you confront him with this claim in the police report, and did he say that's just not accurate?
Yes. He said that he had was not personally bothered by the words that Pascal was using, and did not feel like he was being physically threatened. But when he saw the man on the bicycle spit on Jason, and then Jason pursued him, he placed the 911 call, because he considered that Jason's pursuit of the man who just spit on him, that was exhibiting being physically threatening to another individual. And so that was why he placed the 911 call.
But Jason wasn't charged with physically threatening another individual. He actually was trying to apprehend him and hold him for police for a criminal charge, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so the police instead switched this around.
And we can prove that, because Jason himself filed a 911 call 4 minutes after Chapman.
Chapman say that did he give any insight into whether he then said when the police arrived, well, I was afraid the guy, was going to hurt this other guy, but if, given the circumstances, I also was upset by his, I want to file a charge against him for saying that I'm a cunt, or whatever he said.
Chapman did not file the complaint because of any words that Jason said. He made the 911 call because, in his view, Jason was physically threatening.
Right. I didn't ask why he filed the 911 call. I asked, once the officer arrived, did he ask that the officer fill out a criminal complaint against Jason for fighting words?
No.
This then was police initiated.
What he said to me on the phone yesterday is that he did tell, when he placed the 911 calls, he said that Jason was physically threatening people.
Right. I understand that. I understand all that. Once the officer arrived, and the police also understood that they can't charge Jason with physically threatening somebody who has allegedly assaulted him, and he's simply trying to catch and hold, although I don't know, maybe he was going after him in order to beat him up, it's hard to say, but, once the police were in that situation, you're looking at police reports right now in the studio. I see that familiar large type and the police format and the narratives and so forth,
yeah,
which I guess Jason Gate passed on to you to work on your story for. Is there anywhere in that police report that indicates that Chapman requested a complaint be filed. Was this a citizen's complaint from Chapman about fighting words?
It was a citizen's complaint, and it was about fighting words. Offensive words in public place, misdemeanor, 415.3 PC. And then there was a second charge, 410 PC, neglect or refuse to disperse rioters.
Wow.
Although Jason was never asked to disperse.
And there was no riot apparently in progress.
Well, Chapman claimed in the police report that because of the nature of the comments that Jason was making, that he was sure to provoke a fight. And I said, well, you mean his words that somebody was going to come and punch him, right? And he said, yes. I said, well, isn't that different from, say, saying, I'm going to punch you in the nose, that kind of provoking a fight, or come over here, knock this battery off my shoulder? Some of your listeners have no idea what I'm talking about, but some of the old ones are laughing.
Perhaps so. Well, again, the question to me is, Chapman had some concerns about there being, you know, that Jason's presence there being a provocation. The point of all this to me is that in spite of all these complaints and these police reports, which are always, frankly, a dubious source, and you went directly to the witnesses involved, which is what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that the public defenders don't tell you. This is something that people don't normally do in infraction cases, but they should, is go to the people or get somebody else to go to the person who's making the complaint or has witnessed it and interview them. And then you get information that you can bring to court one way or another. And also, frankly, to free radio so we can find out what the hell went down in these cases. But again, my question to you, Becky, because you have the police reports in hand, is did Chapman indicate that once the police were there, he initiated this complaint for fighting words?
I'm
trying to figure out if the police kind of encouraged him to do it or created it or whether he himself
thought
about it.
In the course of his complaint, he repeated statements that he said that Jason Pascal had said, him and his wife a cunt.
You repeated those statements.
Right.
But when you talked to him, did he say, I wanted him prosecuted for making those statements and I told the police so? When you talked to him in the interview?
Yes. He said that the statements he was making were likely to provoke a fight. And that's what he said. There was two things: that because he was physically threatening another person, the bicyclist, and because of that.
So in other words, we can't blame the police for cooking this up. This did come from Chapman himself.
Well, there's a little question. Chapman told me clearly on the phone that he witnessed the bicycle spit on Jason, on his body. And I said, well, where did the spittle land? And he said, well, I don't think it touched any skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you mean it landed on his clothing? And he said, yes. Now, in the police report, it says he also describes the bicyclist spitting, but he said he spit on the ground. And, of course, when they actually caught the bicyclist and interviewed him, a man named Jeremy Burkett, said that he was there and that he spit on the ground. And he also denies that he used the word, the racial epithet, nigger.
Epithet, describe Jason.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you know, again, to me, in a way, we're doing the tempest and the teapot thing, and people may be wondering why dredge over a 9-month-old case. And I guess the issue is here for me that this is a 9-month-old case that the police have forced Jason to come back to town, what, 5 times to appear in court?
He claims that his transportation and expenses cost him about $5,000. And that's not including the public defender who was appointed by the state.
In fact, he went through several public defenders, I think we talked about, and that, I guess, is another interesting part of the story, right?
Two, right.
I was kind of giving you some concerns. Before we get into the public defenders, is there anything else you wanted to say about stuff we've been talking about up to now. We're talking about the case of Jason Pascal, African-American tarot card reader, who has been repeatedly harassed by police in Santa Cruz. Most recently went through a merry-go-round series of court appearances that finally ended because he refused to accept plea bargains and deals in a dismissal of all charges with no finding of guilty, and he's free to come into Santa Cruz. But he still feels, I believe, probably, if I'm not mistaken, Becky, not too welcome on the streets, right?
Well, you know, Jason has his fans and his supporters, and he has his detractors. He's a controversial person, and but he did make a living on Pacific Avenue by giving tarot card readings and psychic readings. I asked him about that. I said, let me guess. They come and they want to know whether they're about their money or their job, whether they're going to make any money. They want to know about their health, and they want to know about their love interest. And he says, yes, 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 that 99% of the people come, and they all want to know the same
thing. So you're going to set up a stand of your own, Becky, to kind of deal with this new situation, a new form of income for you, perhaps?
I would call that counseling, and I think counselors, it's not unreasonable to pay your counselor for their services. If they're willing to listen to all your problems and give you advice after listening to that, I think that's honorable. I don't want to do that myself, but I don't see why the Santa Cruz Police Department or the Downtown Association or Sergeant Baker made a campaign to run this guy out of town. And they made a shambles of the whole medical marijuana issue with this extradition back to New Hampshire. I mean, huge public expense to do that. Without ever looking at the specifics of the original charge, which was drug war, hysteria, racially motivated.
Wait a minute. Are you using the word hysteria here, Becky Johnson?
Oops. Ooh. That was a lapse. I try not to use the word hysteria because it's an extremely sexist word.
We'll let us proceed.
I know.
I
see you gloating after all the lectures I've given you about it.
We sometimes fall from our high principles. This is actually a private joke, folks. I apologize for making it public.
Never use the word hysteria again.
We'll see. But, I mean, I'll forgive you in either case. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. We've got about 50 minutes left in the show. In the studio with me is Becky Johnson, who's reading police reports and giving us the update for her news story on Jason Pascal, African-American tarot card reader. And you can call in if you want to comment. That's the main reason for this lengthy interruption. 427-3772 is the number. In case you have any thoughts, reflections, interjections, curse words, blessings, you name it. You can call 427-3772. Go ahead, Becky.
Okay, I wanted to read from this police report about one of the eyewitnesses on the sidewalk, a man named Steve Harper. And this is from Officer Vasquez's police report. He says, I also contacted two other subjects in case, Harper and Chapman. We already talked about Bill Chapman. This is Steve Harper. Subject Harper identified himself as a witness to the incident. The following is a summary of what Harper told me. Harper had been walking nearby. Harper saw a bicyclist ride up to Pascal and spit on him. Pascal was hit in the face with the spit. The bicyclist then rode off and Pascal chased after him. Harper described the unknown bicyclist as a skinny, 6'2" white male with a mohawk on a 21-speed bicycle. Harper was unable to provide any more details of the bicyclist. It should be noted that I had seen Pascal speaking privately to Harper after the incident occurred. I asked Harper if he had spoken to Pascal regarding the incident. Pascal was silent for a moment. I told Harper that I had seen him speaking to Pascal after the incident had occurred. Regarding his conversation with Pascal, Harper told me, I don't remember. Harper paused again and then said that Pascal had approached him and asked him if he had seen him getting spit on. Harper told him that he had seen part of the incident. I asked Harper if he knew Pascal previously. Harper said he knew Pascal but did not know the bicyclist. The reason I read that, first off, it was a witness that supported that he'd seen Jason get spit in the face.
And
but
so
the way that the question line of questions are going, everything undermines the credibility of that witness, because he previously knew Jason, because he had been seen talking to him before. And here Jason, who was being charged with the crime, was running around looking to get witnesses, trying to find the witnesses on the scene who could validate him. He certainly had not picked the timing of getting spit in the face. So it's not like he arranged anything like this. And this is what Steve Harper said on the spot. So the case was assigned to Sergeant Baker to investigate the merits of this case.
The person who had previously taken such efforts to get rid of Jason from the downtown area.
Yeah, exactly. Is that ironic?
Interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
And
he was still on active duty. Actually, I saw Sergeant Baker 3 or 4 days ago. He waved at me from a squad car, and I waved back. I don't want to call us old buddies, but we certainly know each other from past times. I actually successfully sued Sergeant Baker, or at least in his official capacity. We got significant financial settlement for a false arrest about two blocks away from where this incident happened, in front of New Leaf Market, back in 2002. Baker arrested me for having a political table, which he claimed was blocking the sidewalk.
Oh, I'm looking, trying to find here.
What I find significant, Becky, mm-hmm. about what you read is one of the concerns was they said the reason they didn't pursue this witness, Steve Harper, or didn't pursue the individual who supposedly, well, who did spit on Jason and rushed off, is because his description was inadequate, even though it sounds like a pretty colorful and pretty unique description. Is that accurate, Becky? Yeah.
I would say that is.
Mohawk.
Here's something.
6 foot something.
Here's what Sergeant Baker said in his report. He said, I have had previous contact with Pascal and know he is regularly involved in disturbances downtown. He has been arrested on numerous occasions for incidents where he challenges others to fight, or actually gets involved in a fight. Never mind that, with few exceptions, the arrests Baker made of Pascal turned out to be bogus. That's me, the comment
right
here. And then here's what else he said in his report. He said, if spittle did actually strike Pascal, this may have constituted a misdemeanor battery per Penal Code 242. But mysteriously, and this is me again, mysteriously considering Harper's testimony, Baker wrote, there is not a witness that corroborates either side of this issue.
Well, it does sound like the police reports there are, including Mark Chapman, the original complainant. It's kind of strange.
Only when he spoke to me yesterday on the telephone did he say that the spittle had actually struck Jason
Pascal. So his recollection now is different than what we understand.
We can't explain why the discrepancy in the report.
You didn't present him with his
I didn't ask him that question,
yeah, okay.
And I wish I had, but
yeah.
Perhaps if he's listening, I did tell him we would be talking about the case on the air today.
Yeah.
He could call in, 427-3772.
Yeah. Mr. Chapman, if you feel like calling in, feel free to do so and certainly give you an opportunity to voice your thoughts. What about everybody else out there? I mean, what's going on here? Are police discriminating against African Americans downtown? Is it just a case of some foul-mouthed, loud-mouthed who needs to be dragged off the avenue and banned from the street somewhere in the middle? What are your experiences? 427-3772 is the number to call in if this case interests you. And while you're thinking about that, let's have a little musical selection so we can... I don't know, I can go out and get a drink of water and do some other necessaries.
How many hearts have you broken? How many men have you lost? How many nights have we spoken? when I couldn't get the point across. How many times have we stood here waiting for your prince to arrive? How many shoulders to cry on does it take to keep the dream alive? Tears have you tasted? How many drinks have we shared? How many nights have been wasted? 'Cause you thought that there was no one there. How many times will you call me, looking for a little relief? How many nights will I wait here, smiling in disbelief? You go home to your lover, I go home to my room. You go home to discover. You've spoken too soon. I'll be there in the window, 'cause there's nothing that I can do. I can do. How many times have I wondered how many years it would take? That you'd see the delusion you're under, that you wouldn't make the same mistake. How many times must I watch you, throwing all your secrets away? How many men will it take you to save them for a rainy day? You go back to your lover, I go back to my home. You go back to recover from those evenings alone. You can choose where you find me. Just a little bit caught in the crush. I'm watching you work and searching for the Midas touch. And with all the perfect strangers who are vying for attention, you will learn that nothing changes except the names you have to mention. There is safety in the numbers. There is safety being sure that there's a safety net below you that will save you from the cure. And the only real advantage in returning to the fold is the words you take for granted and the shelter from the cold. You will back away until you're facing someone more familiar who will fill your fear of loneliness with promises of gold. You'll go on with your lovers, I'll go on with the fight. You'll go under the covers, just to stay aside. I will be there like a shadow, 'cause I'm so tired of saying goodnight. Why would you choose someone who loves you too little over someone who loves you too much? You're leaping and lurching, searching for the Midas touch. Leaping and lurching, searching for the Midas touch.
And that was another Uncle Banzai special from Men and Women, spelled M-Y-N and Y-W-N, Women, W-Y-M-Y-N, Y-Y-Y.
To get the man out of woman.
Well, that could be one interpretation, I suppose. And the name of that song was Midas Touch. It's Free Radio you're listening to. In the studio with me is Becky Johnson. Becky, I guess you had one last thing to say about the Jason Pascal case. You have a kind of a green flyer here about hate crimes, and Jason was trying to...
Well, Jason was upset that the police were not vigorously prosecuting the bicyclist, Jeremy Burkett, and he went down and filed his claim his complaint of being a victim. And the police department gave him a little green trifold pamphlet entitled Hate Violence and Civil Rights, And it's got all the information, how the Department of Fair Employment and Housing enforces California civil law, prohibit hate violence by, they investigate complaints, they prosecute violations of the law, they educate people about hate violence and harassment, discrimination. Anyway, he called the phone numbers listed in this brochure, and none of them worked. They were all dead numbers.
Have you tried them yourself to see if they work?
I have not. You want to try them now?
Sure. What are they? Well, the office is probably closed.
This is an 800 number. Let's see if it works.
All right. Let's give it a try.
Okay. It's 800-884-1684.
800-884-1684. Let's see how this rolls here. Let's try and...
You have reached the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. Si necesita ayuda en español, por favor, quédase en la línea. Our office is closed now.
It looks like there is... that number works. You want to try another one?
And...
Boy, you're destroying your own credibility here on the air, Becky. I congratulate you on your courage.
Well, I'm not sure. You know, you
or
heard
Jason's
this,
credibility.
You're not sure that you that there really was a way to leave a message. Sometimes they just have outgoing messages, and so I'm
that's true.
I'm not entirely sure. Okay, that was the 800 number. Okay,
we can't
TTY number. That's for.
Now, remember, we can't dial long distance unless we're talking 800 numbers. So,
yeah. Okay. Okay, here's the California Attorney General. 800-952-5225.
Welcome to Attorney General Edmund G. Brown, Jr.'s Public Inquiry Unit. For English, press 1. Para español, favor de oprimir el número dos.
Okay. Well.
This automated system is provided to give you the quickest route to our most frequently requested information, including U.S. mail, email, and web page addresses, how to file a consumer complaint, and referrals to our many registries, bureaus, and units.
We can actually, you know, we could carry this on more, but it looks like
there is some kind of outgoing
maybe when he tried it, the numbers weren't running, or maybe he's mistaken, or maybe he's exaggerating the depth of his dilemma. I know that that can happen. I don't think that vitiates the basic concern, because you have a lot of documentation here about police reports. You've talked to actual people, and it looks like there has been, you know, however... Some of the details may not match up. A campaign of harassment against this guy with nothing solid behind it in terms of anything that we need to be concerned about or spend public monies on. But I'm biased, and so are you, because both of us tend to look with sympathy on claims of poor and homeless people performers.
It's a gray area, because we certainly have freedom of speech, but where does freedom of speech cross over into the criminal arena, and where law enforcement has a legitimate concern to come in and prevent that person from speaking out? Is it merely just because of how loud they are? Is it the type of language that is used? If a person is saying things that are very upsetting and confrontational, unpleasant, unwanted, unwelcome, are they still legal?
Let me...
Certainly, I'm not denying that the things Jason said on that his day of protest on July 15th, that they were unwanted, unwelcome, unpopular. But whether they were actually criminal...
Well, yeah, the question is whether it's...
It's
not just that. The question is whether what the police acted in a fair manner, and whether you know, ignoring his complaints about you know, abuse, and instead harassing him at great length because you don't like the way he's presenting himself downtown, or because maybe you have regard for the clientele of O'Neill's than you do for, you know, street performers or, you know, potty mouthed street activists. Some would say that's just fine. That's how our police department should be, because we want to selectively, you know, treat people differently in the community based on whether we want them there. And I guess some people want to give the police those kind of tools. I'm wary about that. I'm not worried about that. I don't think it's a good idea at all. I think the community can decide, and this is really the issue for me, how it selects people. I mean, if people are not wanted, you say, what about someone who's screeching around, playing music that people don't want to hear? Well, the reality is, you know, don't you need a law to get rid of that? And the answer is no. The answer is that because you have public opinion has its own force. People who, if somebody knows they're not wanted after a certain period of time, it has an impact. Now, I suppose some people are very dedicated, evangelists and so forth, who believe deeply. And that, you know, that runs into the freedom of religion. And but then you can start, talking about objective standards like, you know, volume of noise too loud, too persistent. We have noise laws in downtown Santa Cruz that address that issue. In the studio with me is Becky Johnson, and this is Bathrop Spear's Broadsides, the Civil Rights for the Poor show, taking the controversial issue of the harassment of Jason Pascal. I guess the other thing that happened with this whole case that you were not, I want to kind of close it down, but we've already talked about it. Jason was told that if he pled guilty to this whole thing and accepted a plea bargain, that he would leave Pacific Avenue, he would get the crime reduced later in 3 or 4 months to an infraction, take it off his record. But until that time, he would be banned from the area, or at least from Pacific Avenue. And if he didn't, he would have to go to a psychologist for a competency hearing. Now,
Now, that was the issue about whether he could plead not guilty and get a jury trial.
And, of course, this is all his account. And, frankly, with someone who is, with Jason particularly, I'd like to see corroborating documents. If you found any corroborating documents that give you any indication of why Judge Kelly was disqualified from this case, because Kelly was, according to Jason Pascal, the reason that Jason was not allowed to have a jury trial unless he went to a psychologist first to get a competency hearing. Have you ever seen any documentation that supports that or talked to any public defenders around that?
I did talk to his public defender. She promised to pass the order that where the case was transferred out of Judge Tom Kelly's courtroom and into Commissioner Stephen Siegel's courtroom, where basically Kelly was stripped of the case.
And not a usual kind of preemption. This is an unusual ruling from on high. It wasn't because, and the public defender, I guess her name was Caballero, didn't want to do this. She didn't want to go up against Kelly on this. She wanted Jason to take this plea bargain. And I guess, you know, I'm trying to get to the bottom of this issue. Do these documents exist? Why was Kelly removed from the case? Did he really make this outrageous insistence that before getting a jury trial, you're going to have to go to a hedge shrinker and get some kind of, you know, okay? I mean, Jason is loud. He repeats himself. When he gets angry, he can become abusive in language. But I don't think he's crazy, and I don't think he's incompetent. And the idea that he is to me a subterfuge for denying him basic justice.
Well, I mean, it's just, if this is true, and it appears to be from what evidence we've seen so far, Judge Kelly did go to the sidebar with public defender Elizabeth Caballero and said that Jason could, if Jason insisted on pleading not guilty and demanding a jury trial, that Kelly would insist that he go through a competency hearing first.
Is there any
before he would allow that? However,
precedent for this?
Jason could plead guilty or nolo contendere.
Right, we understand that he could avoid the whole thing by essentially copping a plea. But the question here is this an unusual procedure? Has this ever been done before? I've never heard of this happening. I have heard of judges saying, do you really think you have sufficient legal skills to defend yourself? It's a complicated matter doing a trial, and even though it's everyone's right to defend themselves.
No, I've never heard of this, and it just... I'm not an attorney, and this struck me as outrageous.
Did Caballero confirm this is what Kelly did?
She confirmed that she did when in the conference between Jason and his attorney, which I was privileged to be part of. And Jason asked where he could get the proof of what happened to Kelly. how Kelly was removed from the case, and she said that there was an order and that she would get him a copy of that order. However, it did not explain in the order why he'd been removed from the case. So we may still not have as much information
and,
about
and the
that.
The reason he was removed, according to Jason, is, of course, that because he contacted an attorney in Southern California after Caballero refused to take the issue forward and had the attorney in Southern California pressure Caballero, who then saying that he would that he, the attorney, would complain about her to the Bar Association or to the Commission on Judicial
Performance.
It was
actually, he contacted the California Bar Association and then contacted Caballero and told her that Kelly's ruling was, he had basically made an illegal ruling.
And the Caballero had to do something about it, even though she didn't want to. Caballero also didn't want you as a part of this conference, right? Did she not attempt to exclude you at some point?
She did, but I think in the end she was glad I was there because I was able to explain some things to Jason in language he understood.
The point I'm making, though, is that if you go into if you have a conference with a public defender, do not be shy about having a friend present to be with you, to back you up, to assist you, to take notes, and that sort of thing, because public defenders have their own tempo and agenda, which usually involves plea bargaining your case as fast as they fucking can. Forgive me for putting it in that emphatic way. And that can, on some cases, be advantageous to you, but often it is not, particularly if it's a matter of principle and you want to stand your ground. And in order to do that, you often need some moral support from someone else, and also if it's a political or an activist case, it's good to have an activist with you. Public defenders will tell you, I won't do this, I won't allow this, has to be a confidential contact with the client, and the client can say, no, I waive confidentiality, I will let that go by, you're my public defender, I want this person present.
You also, if you're working with an advocate, you might want to put a written statement to your public defender. Please share all. Please speak to and share all materials about my case with so and so. And if it's written in their files, then they are obligated to share it with you.
You would think so.
One would think.
Now we'll find out. Did you get Jason Pascal to write such an order to the former public defender Kristen Carter? Interestingly enough, the woman who won the Obama female slot for delegate last Sunday, as well as the current public defender who was covering Jason Pascal's case. Was it Elizabeth Caballero?
Mm-hmm.
Did you get Pascal to write such a letter and so that you can get access to all those documents? If not, you better get to it, Johnson.
We're past that point because Jason was able to get finally all the documents for his case.
You might want to talk to her about it.
And then when we were at the courthouse, then he verbally waived his confidentiality.
So you can call up Caballero at any point and ask her more questions about this case without her saying, oh, it's a confidentiality matter.
It should be, because he said that he wanted me to be privy to his case.
These folks might say
it was only that conference something else, so we'll see.
Yeah.
Again, that's why I say a letter is much better, because then there's no doubt.
So, you know, we were talking earlier in this program, and it's really kind of been probably the longest thread on the Indy Bay website. That's indybay.org/Santa Cruz. You can Google for it at Santa Cruz Indy Media. The issue of the Coonerty rejection by the Obama delegates as a delegate. Instead, they choose, I guess his name was Luis. What the heck was his name? He was chosen instead of...
Yeah, I didn't know him. I guess he's an attorney from Watsonville, but a lot of people do know him and expressed a lot of confidence, and he's certainly held sway with a substantial number of votes. Somewhat 40, 42 votes more than Ryan Coonerty got.
Right. I'm looking for his last name. I think, you know, there's a lot of personal attacks on this thread against you, against me, against the man who actually organized this fight against Coonerty, Matea Bramana, who also ran as a delegate, also an African-American, coincidentally, who really he's sort of very temperate in this whole approach. You know, he's... It's an interesting thread, and it continues to go on. And, of course, the one person who does not contribute directly to this thread is Ryan Coonerty himself. He doesn't make any comments or public statements. We do have his email back and forth between Matea Brahmana about, you know, how he feels that he's...
That was pretty revealing.
It's pretty... You know, Coonerty is... Frankly, and I don't... I know I'm a critic of his, so people are going to say, you just don't like Coonerty. And I don't like what I'm getting from Coonerty on this, but he's arrogant. He's exclusionary. He's elitist. He looks down on people from the heights. And, you know, this
and he was passing around misinformation in an email that he did not realize at the time would go public. He thought he was only talking to one person. And when he made those statements about yourself, myself, Bernard Klitzner...
Well, actually, these emails don't have any statements about any of us. These emails between... If you go to this website to find out, in the discussion, Coonerty is trying to reassure or bully, and it looks a little like a little of both. He doesn't really do much reassuring. He just sort of dismisses and expresses ridicule and incredulity, and he's supercilious.
But he said that we were banned from all of the homeless services and feeding programs around town.
Well, I'm not interested in what he says about me. I'm interested in what he says about this set of emails that is the beginning of this long thread.
It's just simply not true. It's just making it up to vilify
the threat, Becky, the thread of emails that I'm concerned about here has to do with the issues, not the personalities involved. He doesn't really... our names do not appear in this set of emails, except that somewhere, I guess in a missing email, the names did appear, perhaps. But what does appear is a series of just sort of increasingly haughty responses to... Matea Brahmana, where Brahmana is simply saying, you know, I was homeless. The sleeping ban hurt me. I can't understand how you would support it. And then also claim to be supporting Obama's positions because he came from a position of fighting poverty and he wouldn't oppose such a thing. I don't know that Obama actually does oppose the sleeping ban. In fact, I posed that question in this thread. Nobody's answered it, neither Matea nor the Coonerty supporters. So who knows? I mean... I kind of somehow doubt he would oppose the sleeping ban because it would put him in a position of opposition to a lot of local politicians. But maybe he does. I don't know. Maybe somebody out there who's listening, who's an Obama supporter, can write a letter to that very accessible senator and find out what the story is. You were at this Sunday affair. You were there with us. We played music.
We had seven people from Huff there.
Seven. We had a table. We gave out several hundred pieces of literature. And really, most important, Coonerty lost this battle.
Much to our surprise.
Much to my surprise, certainly. And although others apparently
despite
were not so
surprised.
Despite the
fact that he had all his family members there,
his sisters
high
and his
school,
cousins and his
chums,
aunts, man. He had every, you know, I mean, I want to say every third person was a Coonerty relative, but I ran into more relatives of Coonerty than anybody else there. At least, of course, they would have said that because I was giving out anti-Coonerty literature. It's true. But it was amazing how many Coonertys showed up there. I mean, you know, of course, there was Sheila, and there was Neil, and there was his children, and his family came over, and I said, this is the guy who's denouncing, and I gave them some literature, and I said, it's not personal, you know, I mean, I'm sure, you know, Ryan could be a fine family man, I mean, I don't know, I mean, I assume he is, you know, I mean, why, nothing reason not to assume that, but his political positions are horrible, they're just horrible, and, you know, the community has to know about them, and then decide if they want to support them, you know, he supports laws that criminalize people for innocent behavior in parking lots, and particularly impacts homeless people, he supports sleeping bans, he supports cutting off communication at city council, cutting off public input to an extent that people can't meaningfully comment on three-quarters of the agenda.
He actually said that less public speech at city council is better speech.
Right. I mean, he has these excuses, these pretexts, these rationalizations. That's my view.
He said that the meetings, if they're shorter, that they're more accessible to members of the public. I don't understand the logic of that at all. A shorter meeting means you have a smaller window in which you can get there and possibly weigh in on something.
Well, if you're watching it on television, it takes up less time in your day. Maybe that means it's more accessible in the sense if you want to watch it quickly. Or if you're waiting for a particular agenda item that is allowed a public hearing, and there aren't many of them, but a few of them are, then you can get through the rest of the agenda very quickly because Ryan has cut short, unilaterally cut it short, without going to the council for approval, though I have to say the council has not objected.
He may just be lazy and not like those long meetings for his own physical comfort.
Well, you know, I don't want to say that because, first of all, I have no evidence of that, but I think he believes that the staff presents the city council, the mayor makes up the agenda with the staff every Wednesday before the city council meeting on Tuesday, as it's done, as it did yesterday, and for the next Tuesday city council meeting. And the issue then becomes, you know, it puts a whole bunch of items on what's called the consent agenda, which is usually voted on by the quick up or down vote. And it's a way of getting past items that usually don't provoke a lot of discussion, at least from members of the city council. They've said they don't want a lot of discussion. And presumably, if the mayor is being fair, he is saying, I haven't heard from a lot of people on these items, and therefore I don't think they're worthy of a separate, a particular public comment. But because this is supposed to be a legislative process open to the public and not done at the whim of council members, when a member of the public wants to talk about a particular item, we have the supposed protection of the Brown Act, which says if you want to talk about an item on the agenda, you can, period. You can't say you can't because they don't like you. They can't say you can't because you talked last meeting too many times. They can't say you talked because you talked on other items too much, although Councilmember Rotkin 3 years ago put in a new ruling that does engage in those kinds of illegal and unconstitutional limitations. But Coonerty has gone much further. He has limited all discussion to 2 minutes for three-quarters of the agenda during the afternoon session, which means you have an opportunity to say very little, maybe something of substance about maybe two items if you're fast, unless they give you the opportunity to speak more because a council member decides that you're worthy of speaking or that the issue is worthy of bringing up, which is, you know, and
well, you know,
what do you think of that?
I am kind of equally question. Abhorred by what he's done, where he's changed the power structure, where previously any member of the public or city council member could pull an item off the consent agenda, and it would just go on the regular agenda and be discussed and voted on in a normal fashion. He's changed that, so now it's up to the council themselves whether they will deem to listen to an item on the consent agenda.
Now, we've gone over this a lot. Forget new information out here. What did you notice at this Obama delegate rally? What's interesting to me is not, you know, I thought the people at the Obama delegates were actually very nice. I mean, and Coonerty was nice, too. Coonerty was not nasty to us. Nor, Ryan, I think Neil got a little out front there. But, you know, they provided all kinds of, you had to pay for them, snacks and drinks. But, you know, they didn't try to restrict the media. They didn't try to keep you behind the ropes.
I didn't detect a lot of hostility.
No,
I actually expected to be treated with more hostility than I was.
Yeah.
A lot of people were just completely unaware of the issues. It hadn't crossed their radar screen yet. And so they took the flyers with some interest to see what was going on. And then other people who knew us better. So we're polite, and they'd say, no, thank you, I don't want the flyer. I really didn't encounter a lot of hostility. I was a little surprised by that.
It also has to be said that I have not gotten a rash of phone calls. One of the things on the flyers we gave out, it wasn't just don't vote down Coonerty, he's a bad guy. It was, mm-hmm. Here are four issues that we are concerned about. Here's what you can do about them. We want the DA to prosecute Brown Act violations against the city council. Call this number. You know,
I have another Ryanism.
Hang on. We had a number of numbers that we gave people to call. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, honestly, I've not heard anybody calling in to Huff as a consequence of the information we gave out saying they want to join up. But I still think, you know, we've got to pat ourselves on the back. And we aren't the only ones. We got patted on the back by Matea Bramana, who said Huff members there made the difference in defeating Coonerty.
I think that's highly likely.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I have another Ryan Coonerty-ism. You remember the no party, the party at your peril law?
We talked about this law, actually, a week or two ago. This is a law that increases massive fines for partying based simply upon a police officer's discretion of what constitutes an unruly assembly or an unruly party.
Well, there's an expression that's encoded into that law where it is now a crime to violate the quiet enjoyment of one's property.
That was the phrase added to the old law that made the law so broad that the police could essentially close down anything they want.
Now, Ryan Coonerty defended this, and he says, oh, this is a very common principle in leases and law, and it comes up frequently. It's a very ordinary stipulation. However, it's an ordinary stipulation in your rental contract with your landlord. Your landlord is obligated to leave you in peace once you rent, when you're a tenant. They can't just come barging in whenever they want. They have to give you 24-hour notice and that sort of thing. And so you are given the assurance in a civil contract between your landlord that says that he has to allow you the quiet enjoyment of your property. What Ryan did, constitutional lawyer, he took that expression and turned it into a crime, a criminal law, from civil law to criminal law, and made it a police officer, the police officer's point of view, or what they consider reasonable, that if the quiet enjoyment of the property was violated, then they can charge you with a crime. That is very, very different from the other instances we've
seen in law. In a way, it's a complete reversal, because quiet enjoyment of the property is something usually a property owner has that protects him from being invaded by someone else. What the police officer now has is a license to invade property based upon this new phrase sandwiched into the previous law, which talked about, I believe it talked about health or safety, and then one other thing which would justify an intrusion on the property. Now suddenly, if there's a quiet enjoyment of some adjacent property, can then become a basis for intruding on someone else's property and giving them significant fines that escalate significantly the next time it happens.
And certainly changing the whole noise ordinance, which has different standards before 10 o'clock and after 10 o'clock. I mean, that had been the law of the land for...
It still is. I mean, the law hasn't changed there. But what has changed is this additional law is now used instead of that law. Those laws are used downtown.
With a much lower standard, with actually no standard at all.
It's a police officer's discretion. Again, the idea of giving the police massive discretionary power seems to be what Ryan Coonerty feels is a solution to a lot of problems.
And a way to gouge people with extremely high fines.
Well, again, Rodkin has said, and it's true, that not a lot of people have been fined under this law. However, it is also true that we don't know how many people have stopped having parties as a consequence. And I tried to get somebody on from Project Curb to discuss this.
Mm-hmm.
These were people who actually initially pushed this law. They're concerned about binge drinking, which I think is a concern. I mean, there's no question about it. I don't know if there's no question about it. I don't know what the stats are, but I've always said alcohol is a much bigger problem.
Underage drinking
than
is
marijuana.
Still a crime.
And speaking of which, by the way, before we leave, since we're reaching the last 8 minutes of this program, and you're tuned to Free Radio at 101.1 FM, Freak Radio, we do have something coming up. On Sunday, there's traditionally been a 420 Free the Weed kind of ceremony celebrating. Well, we can't really celebrate yet because there's a huge drug war going on and more people are arrested this year than last year for possession of, sales, cultivation of marijuana. And, of course, the Santa Cruz laws even governing marijuana use in private and police prosecution have been gutted by the city council. But there is an affair happening on campus, which I wanted to point out. That is coming up, and that is going to be an interesting article. You can find this on campus. There's going to be an event on campus in anticipation of April 20th. There is a.
Oh, don't they have that big smoke out in the on the Great Meadow every year?
They do.
I've seen some great videos on YouTube about that.
And what's happening is the university, in response to the proposed smoke out, even though there's a bill being introduced in the House of Representatives by Barney Frank.
So it's 420 April 20th.
Even though there's
Meadow.
A bill being introduced to eliminate all federal penalties for marijuana possession, UCSC administrators apparently, if this is accurate, have put the campus on lockdown in anticipation of 420. And what this means, according to this following memo, was sent to the faculty and staff from the Executive Vice Chancellor David Kliger, or maybe it's Kliger, I don't know. 420 has become known nationwide as the date when people gathered to communally smoke marijuana in expression of support for the reform of the marijuana laws. In recent years, thousands of people have gathered on UCS campus to participate in this event. The university does not condone, support, or otherwise sanction this event. The increasingly large crowds that have gathered in recent years present safety risks for participants, whether students or people not affiliated with the campus. It also violates a number of campus regulations. In anticipation.
Yeah, I remember all of those injuries last year.
Well, that's a question again. The police never provide the stats, at least I haven't seen them recently, and a number of the concerns ranging from the parking lot panic law to the law around the unruly partying. But here, continues Vice Chancellor Kliger, I've authorized the implementation of a number of restrictions for this coming weekend, April 19th through 20th. And these include the west entrance to campus will be closed to inbound vehicular traffic on Sunday. The main entrance will be open that day, but campus personnel will restrict vehicular access to people who have UCSC parking permits or can show evidence they are attending sanctioned campus events that day. Parking permits will be required in all campus lots throughout the weekend, even in those that typically require no permits that day. The parking restrictions will include evening hours on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. At our request, Metro bus drivers will not bring riders onto the campus on Sunday.
Ride a bus on campus.
Try again, caller, very quickly, 427-3772. We have about 5 minutes left. And finally, there will be no on-campus shuttle service during the day on Sunday. Empire Grade will be designated as a tow-away zone, and vehicles that illegally park on Empire Grade during the weekend will be ticketed and may be towed at the owner's expense. Extra patrols will be on duty to enforce those restrictions. Drivers and passengers who can't prove that they have a legitimate reason to be on campus on Sunday will be turned away at the main gate. Here we go. Hi there, you're on free radio.
Yeah, I'm celebrating Hitler's birthday on 420.
Well, all right, Bob. Now we're talking. One of our true heroes, perhaps I don't want to call Coonerty a fan of Hitler's, who is these days. The man is badly, badly misunderstood.
Well, 420, nonetheless, is the birth date of the Führer.
And probably of a number of other people, too, we should be thinking about.
I'll listen.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you.
The mysterious origin of 420.
Another cryptic call from battling Bob LaMonica. Thank you, Bob. Bob actually is...
Nice to hear you're listening, Bob.
Hey, Bob. Well, I think that we're going to have to leave it at that. There is an also interesting thing coming up. The Real Film Festival is coming up. So while you're banned from campus on Sunday for marijuana, it looks like huge amounts of money are going into the Prohibition War up on campus. And there should be some protests. If anybody wants to protest that, please let me know on Sunday. I'll be in the radio station from 9:30 to 1, and I'd be happy to announce any such protests. There is a series of the Real Work Film Festival, 7th Annual Santa Cruz May Day Film Festival, will be coming up. I'll be announcing that in the next show. And you can also go to indiebay.org to get more information about that. We have gotten a very interesting set of course, letters from Robert Letterman and Carol Sobel, who are one of them's attorney, one of them's a street performer, head of Artist, the organization in New York City fighting repression against street artists. There we've had them on the air. They're giving suggestions as to how the situation in Venice Beach and maybe in Santa Cruz can be dealt with. We'll be talking about that on Sunday. If you want to be a part of the human rights organization and the fight to end the criminalization of the poor, come to their meeting on Saturday at 2 o'clock, 131 Front Street at the Firefly Cafe. If you want to call me between times, or if you want to be, if you want to participate in Huff, you can call Huff. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It's 423 Huff. Becky, you get the last word.
Yeah, everybody check out my club cruise on YouTube. It's the Rachel Corey episode. Gasp! So just Google Club Cruise and Rachel Corey. It'll come up. It's in three parts. Watch it and give me a call or email me with your thoughts.
There you have it. Zionist propaganda on my show. Who says I don't allow sinister forces into our studio every now and then? Thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Coming up next, it's going to be Uncle Dennis from the Cream.
Is he going to throw me out now?
We'll see if Uncle Dennis evicts you or not. It could
again?
Be an interesting confrontation could ensue. But in the meantime, Uncle Banzai will attempt to spread oil on the waters and see if peace can yet reign. Peace, you know, that's what they... Peace.
Peace, man.
Peace. Peace out.
Take an E chord, then an A chord, then an E chord, then a B
with a seventh.
Take an E chord, then an A chord. E's a very special key. If an E chord's used with caring, it can lead towards something rare. 'Cause an E chord's never daring. No, an E chord's always fair. Leave the writing to the writers. Leave the singing to the ones who can sing. Leave the fighting to the fighters. Put a padlock on the old sixth string. Take an E chord, play with feeling. That's an E chord filled with pride. 'Cause an E chord's not revealing. And the E chords never hide. Please don't sing. Please don't sing. Please don't sing another folk song.
I've heard them all before. You've heard them all before.
If your part is on the keyboard, then the E chord's a special sound. And when your start is with an E chord, then the E chord comes around.
Leave the strumming to the strummers.
Leave the sing-alongs for those with no shame.
Could the folks be any dumber?
Can't they see that they're the ones to blame?
Please don't sing. Please don't sing. Please don't sing another folk song.
They sound the same to me. They'll sound the same to you.
If a C chord starts the chorus, could a G be far behind? If an F chord doesn't bore us, need the G be redefined? See, a G chord is frustration when the F chord intervenes. But a D chord's modulation is the best chord we have seen. Take an E chord.
it's the acorn and the acorn that makes he a special key.
About when I was a kid, my family used to go to very special places for dinners on special occasions, and this was in Indiana. That's where I grew up, and the thing that I remember most about these places was the orange naga hide motif. There were sort of rolling hills of orange naga hide, kind of like autumn in Vermont. And the interesting thing about this substance is that at certain high temperatures, and you know Indiana gets very warm in the summers, flesh will actually adhere to this. And you'll see people with this sort of embarrassed look on their faces after a pretty hefty meal, and you know they're stuck. And what happens is usually the husbands will sort of help their wives up, and what they usually do is they kind of slap them on the back in the form of a kickstart, and this gets them going. They start to pry off, and it sounds sort of like this. And by God, then they're free. And so they get up, and my family walks in, and my four brothers and I will kind of look around for the moistest spot, right? And we go straight for it, and we sit down, we have ourselves a good game of butt hockey before we start our meal. And that's how we always started our dinners there. So this all happened at the family restaurant.
Chop and a malt for a cheese dog and a can of orange crush. For a host of smiling faces, for a smoking swollen waitress you can trust. Where the kids burp out their orders and they armpit fart for quarters and their parents curse them underneath their breath.